from SLB Radio in Pittsburgh, Crossing Fences. African-American boys and young men creating oral history, showcasing the lives and accomplishments of local African-American men.
I grew up here in Homestead and grew up in the steel mill days, so a lot of steel mills.
Flesh and blood principalities, battle over spiritual policies, thinking that the one is going to follow.
We were responsible for our community. You know, we say we need help, but we got to learn how to help ourselves.
A lot of people who are pioneers and icons who got us to where we are today because they used their brains. If they used their fists, we would never have heard about them.
From anesthesiologists to barbershop owners, entrepreneurs to engineers, and coaches to deacons, over 170 men have been interviewed. Today, let's hear from Representative Jake Wheatley, age 41 at the time of this interview.
I was born and raised in Detroit, and I moved to Pittsburgh in 1997, and I moved here to go to graduate school, and I lived on the Hill. I served in the United States Marine Corps, and coming home after 11 months over in Iraq, I thought that was a great experience and a blessed one. I tell people it's jokingly, but it's kind of a serious matter. I wasn't always the refined person you see before you. When I went into the Marine Corps, I was 17 years old. My mother had to sign me in. I wasn't even of age to sign myself up. And I still had a discipline problem. And United States Marine Corps is not the place you want to be when you're undisciplined, because they will teach you discipline one way or another. This one experience, when we got back, everyone was expected to stand guard. We have a thing called Geneva Convention, and there is a rules of engaging in war. You can't stand guard and have your rifle locked and loaded. Well, again, I'm from Detroit. You're not going to have me out here in the war zone walking at midnight without having a chance to have my rifle locked and loaded. So I refused to stand guard. And in times of war, when you refuse to do something that you're ordered to do, you could be put in jail, court-martialed, or shot on the spot, depending upon how bad the offense is. And the lieutenant that I happened to be attached to, he didn't make me do what I didn't want to do. He came to me, he gave me two books to read. One was the autobiography of Malcolm X, and one was The Art of War. And that changed my life. That gesture and those books changed my life forever. I love service, but I never wanted to be an elected official. Even though I studied political science, I always had a disdain for politicians. It's hard to look at a politician and believe anything they say, because most politicians just want to get reelected. But I did want to work for a politician. I wanted to be one of those people behind the scenes that actually did something. But when they challenged me, it made me think about my role, my responsibility to the next generation. And so when I was running against a state rep. He was 14 years in the state. He had spent 8 years on city council. He was a lifelong resident of the Hill District. But I tell people, if they let the no's stop them from going after their dreams, they can reach anything that they want, and you can do whatever you want to do. Violence is a learned behavior. None of us come out of the womb violent people. We learn in a culture of violence. And so the very first thing I would say as it relates to how do we tackle this issue is we have to name it. People have to say, we have an issue. It's like any type of addiction. You have to first accept that there is something wrong. Then we have to say, there are various levels to this issue that needs to be addressed. Most of this is systemic things that we need to change. Real job opportunities for folk, education. We need to really push and promote quality education. I'm talking about helping men and women determine how to be men and women without being physical. You have to unlearn that behavior. I think idle time leads itself to bad behaviors for youth especially. Totally eliminate violence. Some people say it can't be done. I say whenever you say can't, that's probably mean that you don't want to put the effort in. You do have a historical significance to the Hill District that I think is very special. Part of it has to do with the people. And this really can be said about all of Pittsburgh. I mean, I think it's very family-centered, communal-centered, and you don't get that in every place. So I think that makes it special. I think the historical significance and how it is located over the times, its battles that it has had to just stay with its identity in the mix of all the transition and change that has happened. I mean, this was seen as the crossword of the jazz universe between New York and Chicago. The baseball history that we have here, Negro baseball history right up on Bedford. Teenie Harris, one of the greatest photographers that we've had. The Pittsburgh Courier, one of the leading news media outlets, black or white, of its time, was right here in the Hill District. So you have all these special things that have gone into really the history of the Hill and the love of the Hill. And it's our living histories that we need to hold dear, and we need to promote them. And hopefully when they're hanging on to it, they're using this past to help us move to our better futures. If we don't become more honest with ourselves about the social politics and the racial politics in the city, it's going to be very difficult for us to really solve these major issues we have. When you try to skirt around it, you're always going to have this distrust that's mounting. You're always going to have this subsurface level animosity. Pittsburgh African American families were the most impoverished of the 50 large cities in the country. I think that is the bell that should be going off in every policymaker's brain, every social organization brain, every nonprofit's brain to say, okay, yeah, you want to resolve crime and violence. If you want to resolve the education crises, if you want to really talk about neighborhood development and communal development, we got to attack poverty. Regardless if you're white, black, brown, or red, if we give you true opportunity, fair opportunity, we give you quality schools, we give you quality opportunities around job placements, and we really craft that, we can hold ourselves accountable. If we say we want to make sure that over the next 5 years, we reduce the number of African-American children who are living in poverty by so many, then we name it, we hold ourselves accountable, we see it as a priority, people can understand where we're trying to go, and we can go there. But when we don't want to really have it as a priority plank, then it doesn't happen. You know, we're getting a lot of accolades across the nation. One of the most livable cities, again, a hidden jewel, you know. And I think it's a tale of two cities, kind of. It's a tale of those who have and those who have not. Like our country is going, you're starting to have more haves and more have-nots. And I think if only we can get our political minds together, get our social minds together, and our business minds, because one can't drive the other one without all of us being at the table. And I think that's where you really need to have engaged citizens like yourselves, keeping the issue in front of all of us as leaders. You sometimes have to drive leaders to the agenda.
This oral history was collected by youth interviewers David Jones and Isaiah Bryce Pickens. Crossing Fences is made possible by the Heinz Endowments and was produced by SLB Radio Productions. Learn more at crossingfences.org.